Promos in 3, 2, 1.
Darren, it's so exciting. The Inglorious Live Tour 2023 is continuing, and with the lead singer, me, on guitar, it's Darren Doctorman, and on drums, it's Ashley Edward Miller. What a band.
Sometimes I like to switch to drums occasionally and just, you know, push Ashley off to the side.
Well, we're thrilled because we are having such a great time around these wonderful United States. And it's only because we haven't been invited to Europe yet.
It's our mostly live tour.
It's our mostly live tour. And it's been terrific. And we're going to be, as you know, obviously we go every year. It's been a long tradition. We'll be back at the San Diego Comic-Con July 19th through the 23rd. And of course, we're looking forward to bringing the great Starship Smackdown back to San Diego. Then the following week, July 27th to the 30th, we're going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. Did I say that right?
Or Raleigh.
Oh, okay. One day I'll get it right.
We're going to rally to pronounce Raleigh correctly.
We're not the only ones. Guardian of the Galaxy, Karen Gillan will be there. Charlie Cox from the Daredevil himself. Paul Wesley, who you know and love from Vampire Diaries.
That's right.
Ian Somerhalder also. Stephen Amell. He did not fail the city. He's going to be there. And Billy Dee Williams. Will he have any Colt 45?
That'll be exciting.
Oh,
look
bye.
Who we have here.
That's right. You surely belong with us here in North Carolina.
In Raleigh.
Find out if the gas mining business is really starting to pay off. Marina Sirtis will be there, feeling great joy and gratitude for her invitation. John DeLancey. Coming off his spectacular cameo appearance in Picard. I think people are going to have a lot of questions for the great John DeLancey. Yeah, Brent Spiner will be there. Gates McFadden, Denise Crosby, and Will Friedle.
It's going to be a hoot.
It's going to be a hoot. But you know what? You know who I'm most excited about? And I'm sure we'll be doing the Q&A with him for our first Q&A with him. Todd Stashwick.
Nice.
No. Yes.
Yes.
No, I'm therefore going anyway. that's going to be great. He's hitting the convention circuit big time, and I think people are really excited to see him. So I know we are.
And he's selling t-shirts.
Is he?
I think so.
Okay. Now, if you missed us in San Diego and you missed us at North Carolina, guess where we're going to be the next weekend?
Next weekend is something big.
Yeah, it is. It's the 57-year mission convention in Las Vegas, Nevada, with our friends at Creation Entertainment, August 3rd through the 6th.
That's going to be a big one.
Yeah, that's going to be big because I think it's a lot of excitement about Star Trek after Picard season 3. So people are going to be there and they're going to be excited. Hopefully, it would see all these. I can't even begin to list everyone that's going to be there. It's quite a bit of people. But
I'm trying to arrange some karaoke time.
What?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about.
Karaoke time.
I'm trying to get involved with some karaoke with people we know.
Oh, okay. I just got it. Okay. The following month, we're going to be in Austin, Texas, the great Austin, Texas. Don't mess with Texas. September 1st through the 3rd. Once again, Ashley Miller will be joining us, and the great Jonathan Frakes will be there along with many other members of the cast. Our favorite person,
another great Galaxy Con.
Yeah. And Bill Shatner, of course, will be there. Giancarlo Esposito, Brett Basinger from from Stargirl, Chris Sarandon from Fright Night.
Nice.
And I don't know how I'm going to not get away with not bringing my son, because Matt Lanter, who plays Anakin on the Clone Wars, and James Arnold Taylor, who plays Obi-Wan, are both going to be there. I think Isaac is going to be demanding. I demand it that I bring him to Austin. We'll see what happens.
I just want to keep walking by the Obi-Wan actors booth and just say, hello there. Just keep doing it all weekend.
That sounds great. Well, if you want more information about any of these conventions or Columbus, Ohio, December 1st through the 3rd, go to galaxycon.com. where you can find out more of these great GalaxyCon conventions. If you're interested in San Diego, ComicCon.org, and of course, creationent.com for Las Vegas, Nevada. We hope to see you at one or all of these shows in the coming months. And until then, on behalf of Darren, Ashley Miller, and myself, keep on trekking all the way to North Carolina, ingloriously, of course. Okay. Hey, Darren, have you heard about Trekspers Plus yet?
Heard about it. We've done it.
What it's are you amazing. Talking
about? Of course I've heard about it.
It's so cool. You're getting the whole Trekspers experience, but you're also getting a new podcast from us, the Inglourious Trekspers, Deck 78.
This is true. It's like hanging with us in the lounge on a starship.
But also cool guests talking about cool subjects. Trek adjacent topics like Alien, Battle Beyond the Stars, RoboCop, Logan's Run, The Black Hole, you name it.
And
we'll be there.
Who knows? There might be a little one about The Godfather someday.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Maybe
I want to do that.
Maybe won't be able to refuse that.
They won't indeed. So it's real easy to join. If you want to support the podcast and become a member of Trekspers Plus to get all the great Trekspers Plus goodness, you want to go to trekspersplus.com, trekspersplus.com.
All
and
one
take
word,
off one
all
for
spelled
savings.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah, you can sign up, it's very easy, and then from there on out, you can enjoy the full experience and
you can be
find
among
your
the
way
chosen
to Deck 78, the hidden deck of the Starship Enterprise. And the Inglourious Trekspers, where we hang out.
Well, yeah. It's all good. Join us.
TheTrekspersPlus.com.
This is Peter Holmstrom, and if you're a fan of Star Trek, check out my new book, The Center Seat, 55 Years of Trek, the official companion book to the hit documentary series by the Nacelle Company, which chronicles the history of Star Trek from the early days of Lucille Ball and Desilu all the way to through the end of Enterprise, featuring new and expanded interviews from Trek legends such as David Gerrold, Rick Berman, Ronald D. Moore, Harold Livingston, Walter Koenig, Kate Mulgrew, Nana Visitor, Robert Picardo, Tim Russ, Brandon Braga, Lisa Klink, and of course, Inglourious Trekspert's own Mark A. Altman, as well as the final interviews from Kirstie Alley and Leonard Nimoy, in addition to so, so many more. Pick up The Center Seat, 55 Years of Trek, available today in hardcover and digital, wherever books are sold.
Who are you?
I am the emissary.
Destroy an entire society.
I was sent here to help bring Bajor into the Federation.
Will one mistake?
I pushed him.
What happened on the promenade was just the beginning.
Tear apart years of diplomacy.
I have failed my mission.
Will one confrontation?
You're challenging my claim.
Push Sisko to the limit on the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Brainies, to the briefing room.
Welcome to the Trekspert's briefing room, where industry professionals curate audio commentaries with the creators, creatives, and diehard fans of the Star Trek franchise. My name is Peter Holmstrom. I'm a screenwriter, and I have a new book, The Center Seat, 55 Years of Star Trek, out in stores right now.
And I'm Lisa Klink. I was a writer on Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and I'll be on the picket lines until we get a fair deal.
That's very true. That's... in retrospect, the 1990s proved a fascinating time for television and film and the critical examination of religion. Questions mainstream content hadn't quite asked were now being asked, and a new push towards perhaps an agnostic or atheistic take was taking hold. Perhaps this was because of the proliferation of the information highway known as the internet and the ability for people to ask more questions than ever before, or perhaps it was just the natural evolution of media. For once you've done the pro-religious projects of the 50s and 60s and the nihilistic projects of the 70s, a mixture of the two can come around in the 1990s. On today's show, we have a professor of philosophy and co-writer editor of such books as Breaking Bad and Philosophy, Star Wars and Philosophy, and Star Trek and Philosophy. Kevin Decker is on the show today to discuss a fascinating episode of Deep Space Nine from Season 4, Accession. Kevin Decker, no relation, I believe, to Matt or Will Decker. Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, no relation yet. I have instructed instructed my two children that they should consider the naming very carefully of their children. But it's amazing how few jokes I actually don't get about my last name, because those characters just didn't break through enough to kind of gel in their minds. So
we're working to change that here at the
Breeding. I appreciate that. And it's a great honor to be here again. I mentioned this to Lisa before, but thank you both for your work on creating originally and then preserving the tradition of Star Trek as something that is so distinctively American in its contribution to sci-fi, in the same way that Doctor Who is, and the contribution to science fantasy in the British tradition. I think it takes more than a village. It takes a planet full of us to kind of keep the ships flying. So thank you for your work.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you did on Ultimate Star Trek and Philosophy. I mean, that's a great book.
So there have been a couple of those, and we actually had tried for a third one after Jason Eberle, who's been on your show previously, after we did a third Star Wars book. And the third Star Trek, I was really interested in changing the format to focus each chapter on one character. Which we've always done thematic stuff before. We solicit ideas of any sort from the larger community. We get graduate students, we get full professors, we get retired people, we get international contributors. But I was really thinking that there are some characters in Star Trek who have not appeared very prominently, like Deanna Troi in the previous chapters. And although we try to fill those holes in the table of contents, sometimes it's a question of, is there work in philosophy being done that relates to this character? So, for example, philosophers for thousands of years really had derided the role of emotions in human life, right? And instead prized reason. And this ties into denigration of the body. You know, Socrates says, the philosopher is trying to train themselves to get used to being a soul without a body. And so this is why we constantly talk to each other and don't go and just drink wine. Well, he did drink wine all the time. There was that. But so more recent work by people like Martha Nussbaum, who's very well known on the emotions, on an attempt to kind of retrieve the importance of the emotions, I would think would be at the core of a chapter on Counselor Troi. So still hope to do something like that one day, but the publishers are very sensitive to media and what's coming out and what will drive sales.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's been. A friend of mine, for example, proposed a Twilight Zone in philosophy book, which is, you know, it's a no-brainer, right? But the question is, you know, is there something exciting going on with the Twilight Zone? Maybe in theaters, no. And so, yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah.
It is. I think it's a huge miscalculation on their part. Like, I can understand, like, someone like a Breaking Bad in philosophy might only be relevant for when Breaking Bad is on. But I feel like Star Trek, we're always talking about philosophy in relation to Star Trek for episodes from 55 years ago. You know, it's such an evergreen title.
And it really is. It's an intrinsically philosophical show, at least for the first, as you say, 55 years, Peter, in your book. Yeah. I have debates with people these days about how philosophical it is, because there is philosophy still in it, but I often find that it's more of a veneer and less of episodes that kind of leave you at the end going, what was the right solution to Tuvix, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
people are disturbed by episodes like Tuvix. And so I think the desire to kind of wrap things up in a nice, neat bow or whatever is not really good for Star Trek, because it's supposed to leave questions unanswered.
I agree. And I think it's something we talk about too, of how much we, we kind of miss the episodic television format.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I was just showing my girlfriend the other day for, she hasn't seen Star Trek before, so I've been showing her TNG, and we just got to yesterday's Enterprise, which is just like one of the greatest episodes of television ever made, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And like, that you remember that, you know, whereas something like Discovery or Picard, you know, even though I enjoyed season three of Picard a lot, it's like, it's hard to know what episode is an episode. It's just one big story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I miss those days of like, you have a compact, like, this is the thing, this is the problem we're addressing, this is the thing that can leave you at the end being like, wow, I completely am rethinking my opinion on stuff now.
And I want to say one more thing quickly with the old show, this lovely, naive kind of lack of concern for continuity. I mean, right? I mean, it's going to be the same. The commands are going to be the same. Crew's going to be the same. But and Doctor Who was like that too, when it used to have individual script writers who might or might not come back for another episode later on down the line. And it's kind of delightful to just be able to bask in it creating itself, rather than have to worry about, you know, continuity errors or whatever. At least
that last time. Oh yeah, there are plenty of fans to worry about that.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, let's get right on into this episode here. So for listeners out there, we're going to be watching season 4, episode 17 of Deep Space Nine, Accession. I kept mispronouncing it in my head as Ascension. It is not Ascension. It is Accession.
Yeah.
And it is the episode in which a spaceship comes out of the wormhole carrying a passenger who is from 300 years previous and from Bajor, and believes that he is, in fact, the emissary, which goes counter to what Benjamin Sisko has been being told for the last 4 seasons. So we are going to get this started here from the 00 mark in 3, 2, 1, engage.
So Kevin, you chose this episode to talk about. Why this one in particular?
Well, this and Who Watches the Watchers are two episodes that I decided to focus on in my chapter from the Ultimate Star Trek and Society, which is on Star Trek Secular Society. There are two chapters at the end of the book that discuss different aspects of what's going on with religion in Star Trek. And one of our frequent contributors to Star Wars and Star Trek books, James McGrath, was talking about the potential for humans to achieve a kind of divinity of a sort in a chapter. And my chapter, I think, is more kind of aggressively secular or aggressively agnostic or atheistic. I don't think I out myself as an atheist in the chapter, but so this is an interesting episode because Accession, to me, is not a huge standout in this remarkable season in which the show continues to find out how many things it can put at risk and now on board. And we've got an episode right after this one, like Hard Time with O'Brien, you know, having to suffer through his imprisonment. But this episode does throw a monkey wrench into, of course, one of the big arcs of Deep Space Nine, which is Sisko's uncomfortable position as someone who, I don't know if he worships baseball, and that's pretty much it. Creole food, maybe Creole food and baseball, but... We know it's fun to see him. It's fun to see him squirm as the emissary sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. And in this episode, after the credits, I believe we see him performing a kind of a blessing for a Bajoran couple.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, Dax is like, "Do you remember all the lines?" You know. And it's clear that although he's probably done this a dozen of times, that it's his fundamental discomfort with the position that he's in that makes it difficult for him. So here we've got some influence here. What a remarkable depiction of a religion across 7 years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think we've ever gotten that level of detail in televised or movie science fiction of a so-called alien.
No, I guess not. I mean... Religion. You could maybe say the Jedi in Star Wars, but I would even say Bajor goes further, and
Yeah, I agree. It does. And it goes further in different ways. Like, what happens to your worldwide religion when your planet is conquered?
Yeah.
Does it go underground? You know, does it collaborate? I mean, we saw examples of all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the discomfort.
This episode actually.
Yes.
Yeah, this episode does something fascinating. I found rewatching again, I was like, oh, wow, that is so fascinating, is that they postulate that because of the occupation, the caste system of Bajor had to fall apart. That for previous time of their existence, so this, Bajor had been under a caste system style of society, which is...
And I wanted to check into this, and I didn't get time to, but I wondered if there were other episodes that discuss the caste system, because right now I don't remember that there are.
I don't think so, but
I thought they mentioned it in terms of like bringing it back, you know, as Bajoran tradition, and having like a philosophical debate about whether or not to reinstate the caste system.
No, and they definitely do that here. And I'm just wondering, and it's a great part of the episode that again puts Sisko in a very difficult position. Love this, by the way, speaking of continuity, we've had Sisko and Sun working on their lightship, and then when something emerges from the wormhole from 200 years ago, it's a lightship.
It does, in a way. I mean, this episode was written by Jane Espenson. It was a freelance script, and she had previously submitted story ideas, much as Lisa, you did yourself to the Next Generation, and got some traction through that. But this was a freelance script. This was kind of, you know, she wasn't on staff for the season. But in a way, it almost feels like an episode that could have, maybe should have come in like season two or something. Like, you know, watching in the spectrum of the whole series, it's like, Sisko, you've seen some stuff as the emissary. like some stuff has happened, and yet now he's very eager just to be like, oh no, I'm not the emissary, it's fine.
Yeah, no, he is he turns it over pretty easily. The actor here, Richard Libertini, playing Akoram Lan, who has just come out of the wormhole as has been held, I guess, there more or less by the prophets, has a really difficult job here, right? Because the actor has to have the right amount of gravitas to A, not immediately seem villainous, although he provides the break in the story that drives the drama. But at the same time, he has to be credible as an older emissary for the people, that they would flock to him, right, and be willing to drop Sisko and potentially make all these major changes in society that you suggest.
Well, and I think it's a bold and great move for them to have made, is that, like, he often in religion, it's not always like the mustache twirling guy who's gonna instigate terrible things. It's like, it's actually the guy who you think is saying all the right things, and you want to believe him just because
I think Deep Space Nine does a really good job of drawing a balance between characters like Vedic Wynn, who are as close to mustache twirling as you can get. What a great job that she did. And other characters who are extremely sympathetic, like Shakar.
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting now Kira Nerys's boyfriend.
Baryl.
Oh, Baryl. Baryl.
Yeah.
What an unfortunate end to him. Sorry, spoilers.
But,
it's great stuff. And of course, Kira is frequently torn between these figures who she respects as authorities. And that gives us a lot of good narrative. Loved that this is the updated theme title and pacing for the, is that right, in series four?
Yes. Season four starts that up, A little bit of drum action going on.
I love it. Yeah. A little bit of red nebula stuff going on in the opening credits that makes it more beautiful to look at. Yeah.
Richard Libertini's great character actor of guy. He pops into all sorts of stuff. He was in an episode of Columbo in like the 80s version of Twilight Zone. Small roles in movies like Bonfires of the Vanity and Fletch, Chevy Chase movie. possibly best known for his like voice work in animation. He worked in a DuckTales series for a long time. He's kind of a supporting character in that series. But he does a great job here.
Yeah. Growing up with this, and then I say growing up, I mean, I was a young adult in my 20s or whatever, but I loved all the characters from this show, but I was most enthralled with Alexander Siddig / Siddigal Fadil's character.
Yeah.
You know, excited about frontier medicine and just kind of putting his foot in it every so often. But
yep.
I did go to a con with him, and he was the main speaker. It was a very small con, and he was very entertaining in person. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Good storyteller.
Yeah, I was always drawn to that character too. I mean, the Deep Space Nine episode I did was a Bashir episode, because I had the same idea of, you know, this guy who's, you know, surprisingly kind of naive and idealistic, you know, and how do we torture that character and make him compromise?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of good Bashir episodes are torture Bashir episodes.
Yeah.
that's
a good point. Yeah. Also did really love how they developed the friendship between him and Miles. And
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, the B story in this one, I think, has to do with Rosalind Chow's character, Miles' wife, being pregnant.
Right.
And he's trying to decide whether he can cope with that or not.
Yeah.
It was frustrating to me watching the show that they were apart so frequently. And I was like, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do that.
I honestly kind of have grown to appreciate, like, it's such a great note that you never see in movies or TV shows. Like O'Brien doesn't really like his wife. Like he I think he loves her, and they like they can't not be married, but like he doesn't really like to spend time with her. I think we're going on in a lot of marriages that are exactly like that.
Yes.
But this episode, it opened with Keiko being gone for 6 months, and that was established in an earlier episode that she was going to be gone on Bajor for a long time. And you know, they never quite figured out what to do with Keiko. I mean, early on in the series, she was a teacher on the station, then she kind of gets more into a sciencey role, but
it's true. Here's the part in the episode where they first mention the word for the caste system, the Dijiles. I had a student in my intro to philosophy class bring this issue up recently because we were discussing a Arabic philosopher named Al-Farabi. I'm sorry, he's Turkish. And he wrote a religious version of Plato's Republic called The Virtuous City. And what I kept driving the students toward is this idea of, what do you think? I mean, if we had a society in which everybody had their talents assessed when they were relatively young, and it was found what it was easiest and what they were best at doing and what was easy for them to do given their talents and skills, surely we would want, for the harmony of society, for people to be doing jobs that they're good at, and everybody does the job they're good at, right? And a lot of the students are like, yeah, sure, that's no problem at all. It takes a little bit, right? You have to poke and prod, and you have to say, but what that means is you're doing that job your entire life, even if you decide you don't like it.
Yeah.
And one kid raises his hand and says, oh, it's the caste system. And I say, okay, now we're smoking.
Yep.
Now we're going, right? We can talk about that. And I had this episode in the back of my head, although I didn't mention it to them because half my class hasn't even seen a Star Wars movie. Sisko has to decide now
whether
the Bajorans will accept a Quorum Long, which is not an unresolved question, or not a resolved question yet, and he's off the hook. How does it feel?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
And he's severely torn about it here. You know, he would assume that it would feel good, but it kind of doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Really? I think it's relief we're seeing right
really?
Here.
Really? I don't know. I always thought that it was that he wasn't quite as sure as he thought he'd be.
I think by the end, absolutely. He's you know, obviously, I mean, this is his arc.
When he says, I feel like I'm on vacation. Yeah, that's probably the high point of it. I think he's torn.
Yeah.
I don't think you leave something like that behind all that easy.
I think it's in any other episode, I would have said he would have been torn in this situation. But I think in this episode, in this context, as it was written and as it was performed, he's relieved in that scene. I'm not saying it's a good choice. I'm just saying like that's my reading of his performance in that moment. But and then by the end of the episode, he's having to fight to get the role back. I love this little moment up here. Cord is talking about Nog's childhood, being read stories as a baby. And it's always fun when you get these little insights into see Brock acquire. Acquire Brock acquire. Little reference to that childhood book, See Somebody Spot has Run. Not run
exactly.
Spot, run. I love that stuff. It's great.
The Ferengi philosophy also reminds me of something. I did not address this in my chapter in Ultimate Star Trek, but there is a propensity that a lot of us have to say, for example, that for the Ferengi, their religion is acquisition or money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I've gotten kind of resistant in classes when I hear students say, well, Republicans just make a religion out of certain political principles or whatever. Partly because I want to say if everything is a religion, then nothing is a religion, right?
Yeah.
Well, that concept doesn't have any content. But also, it seems to me like it's just conflating two very different ways of seeing something, which is one, having it inform your identity and your life. And then on the other hand, having it do that because in reality, there is a divine power. Or there is something that is to be worshipped or adored or both.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we see lots of examples of both regular religious believers and people like Quark even having to draw the line in what they will do for what commands them, or what draws them. But in the chapter in Ultimate Star Trek, one of the things I was really concerned about was, what does a religion do when it becomes very powerful in a society?
Yeah.
Specifically in a liberal democratic society. And certainly in Deep Space Nine, Next Generation, Voyager, I think they're relating to each other in ways that are kind of models for an ideal liberal democratic society, right?
Mm-hmm.
Toleration of difference and, ways of settling problems that don't depend upon violence and things like that. I'm going to stop. There's a crucial scene right here, right? And we got to watch Kira's face as the declaration is made that the Dajaras are coming back.
Yeah.
She's pretty nervous but excited. And of course, Odo, the ultimate outsider. Mm. Always gets to poke and prod people and say, "Is this really what you wanted?"
Yep, yep.
Yeah,
they're gonna make Bajor great again, Kevin. This is-
I can't tell you how lost at sea I was for a couple days after hearing about René Auberjonois' death. He just a unique actor.
Mm-hmm.
I think. And one,
yeah, he directed one of my episodes on Voyager. He was a great guy.
Yeah, I had heard that he was a wonderful person. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of complex emotions going on in this scene.
That's right. When I rewatched this before our talk today, I wanted to try to catch the faces of as many extras as I could to see what they were emoting.
Yeah.
And it is. It's kind of all over the place.
It's mm-hmm. honestly unfortunate because, as much as I said earlier, like I miss the days of episodic television, like this is a story that could have been milked for more episodes. Like you could have really played it where like this character could take the place of Kai Winn for a 10 episode arc or something like that as kind of your antagonist on Bajor or something. And because they really move here in this episode. Like, they are just, like, moving through the motions very quickly.
They are. They do. Yes, you're right.
And
this comes pretty... I don't know how far in we are, but this revelation comes pretty soon.
Comes pretty quick, yeah.
Yeah.
And then and the shit starts hitting the fan very quick, too.
Okoromlan has already pointed out to Major Kira that her family is not a military family.
Right.
And so, effectively, she's thinking at this point that she's going to have to change her life fundamentally.
Yeah.
Certainly been willing to do that, but of course, usually on her own terms.
Yeah, well, that's the trick, is having the choice.
Right. That's right. I love the backhand clapping. The
backhanded clap, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like Battlestar Galactica with the edges cut off of the paper. Any little...
Right, yeah. It's that little thing. That little thing. It's nice.
Yeah.
And of course, now Sisko has reason to feel a little guilty again now, because this wouldn't have happened if he had given up his position.
Well, and it's doubly interesting, too, on multiple fronts, that like if they reinstigate the caste system, Bajor's not getting into the Federation.
Yeah, that's
right.
Because of that, Sisko will no longer be able to be there, which will obviously affect the war as well. And like it's interesting on two fronts. Like, I think it's interesting that like Sisko and the Federation are in some ways not willing to be tolerant, to use that loaded term, but tolerant of a culture that is just, you know, there are cultures even in our own world that do exist on a caste system.
That's
right. And like the Federation, you know, I think especially in Star Trek of today, it's like, oh, we accept everyone. We love everyone. You know, we're just, that's Starfleet. And yet, you know, especially in this era and before, there, it's like, no, there are lines they won't cross. And this is one.
Yeah.
And like genetic engineering, it's another one. Like the whole whole notion of kind of transhumanism is almost a non-thing in Star Trek. And like, you know, it's just fascinating to dig into that more and like actually push and pull against that.
No, it's a really good point, Peter. And so India, for example, the caste system clearly exists there.
Mm-hmm.
Its power has broken down a little bit, but India has been, at least until Modi, one of the most robustly democratic cultures in that part of the world. And even looks good by some metrics against like the United States and Britain. So these things can coexist with each other. Typically, we get people interested in pitching a chapter for one of the Star Trek and philosophy books to deal with the philosophy behind the Prime Directive and specifically how it's tied to warp-capable civilizations. Mm. Because one of the first things that in an ethics class we want to talk about is how is's and oughts don't fold into each other. You know, the mere fact that a culture has a certain level of technological development doesn't have a necessary implication for their moral development or, you know, or their ability for them to get into a wider milieu. And of course, you know, authors really differ about that, about whether the Starfleet is being way too judgmental, Federation too judgmental, what technology could possibly have to do with it, you know.
Well, in the chapter, in your chapter in the book, you talk about how Gene Roddenberry was essentially a secularist. And so his vision of Starfleet and the Prime Directive, I think, really did come from a secular point of view.
Yeah, I think it did. I think he really wanted to be that. In digging into some research for that, it's interesting to see how that gets tempered in The Next Generation after the first couple of years when he doesn't have as much influence on the show. And so people that your listeners know well, like Jerry Taylor and Rick Berman, are looking for a wider vision without producing a film like God Isn't Dead or whatever. And I think that they largely do that. And Lisa, we briefly spoke last time we chatted about how Voyager does that. Like in sacred ground in very clever ways, I think very interesting and provocative ways. The thing that's interesting to me is when you try to put your finger on Roddenberry's secularism, I think that's the best word, because I don't know what his belief was about the existence of God. I suspect he strongly, you know, doubted it or disbelieved that God existed, but is how that goes together with what some philosophers call agonism or agonistic thinking, the idea that change, good change, only comes as a result of struggle.
Hmm.
And so what we normally see in original Trek episodes is the Kirk 1-2 punch of you're an overbearing deity-like, you know, oppressor, and the people don't want your help anyway, Vol or whoever, because, you know, humans only get better through agony, through struggle, right? Not necessarily through agony. And Kirk constantly says that. He constantly flouts the philosophy of you have to kind of leave people to make their own mistakes, which is an interesting notion.
Yeah. Except when Kirk decides that he's going to fix everything.
Exactly. Yeah. The first philosophy book had one of those too, where it said Kirk is inconsistent, right?
Yep.
In that regard, and in a few others as well. Love the design. Love that they went to so much trouble to be able to film in darker settings. I know that's
is the last on-screen appearance of Kyle Paca.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Played by Camille Saviola.
Mm-hmm.
But she was great. She died very quickly, and not the actress, but the character died very quickly in season one. And but then she pops in up a couple of times in Visions like this.
Right.
As a Force ghost, yeah.
As a Force ghost, yes. That's what she is. This would prove to be the last time.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the fact that the show, Bashir's asking Sisko now, you know, what he experienced and trying to figure out whether there's a scientific explanation for it. They never really put their finger on what the prophets are.
Yeah.
Why they live in the wormhole and that sort of thing. I think that was ultimately the right decision.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't want to pin it down too specifically. Yeah.
And I don't think fans really wanted a resolution to that by the end of the show. And in many ways, they got the opposite of that, right? Because Sisko is gone and, you know, under weird religious circumstances. And, you know, are they protecting him like they kept Coram Lon for 200 years? Who knows? You know? I know the books have him come back, the novelization.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's always fascinating to me when you're talking about non-corporeal beings that, like, like this or like Q or whatever. I mean, time means nothing to them. So like, you know, this new emissary that came back after 300 years, you get the sense at the end of the episode that like prophets don't really know what they've done. Like, I think for them, it's like they have no comprehension that 300 years have even passed. And but it is a weird give and take where it's like, but yet Sisko is living in a temporal existence and is seeing stuff linearly and is interacting with those prophets in a linear fashion. So therefore, prophets themselves have to, in some ways, be building off of their past experiences with Sisko in a certain linear way.
Yeah, that's right.
But they don't at the same time, so it's all very confusing.
Science fiction concepts that don't lend themselves well to the kind of standard linear narrative, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Hard to do. But you did put your finger, Peter, on a thing that has bugged me since I was a kid, which is this kind of non-explanation of, you know, why is there evil in the world, Mom, Dad? God has it there for mysterious reasons of his own. And when I teach religious philosophers like St. Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas in my historical classes, I frequently have to confront students with this notion that many Christian philosophers and Islamic philosophers believe that there is, in fact, a reason for everything that happens.
Right.
But you and I not only don't know that reason, but that humanity may never know that reason, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a reason.
Right.
So little Kevin, who kind of lost his religion around age 18, is going, no, that's not fair. Don't accept.
Yeah.
I try to be respectful, you know, of where they're coming from.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly nice to have people who don't come from a Christian background in my classes, Jewish students occasionally, Saudi Islamic students, because I would really like to give them a platform not to proselytize, but to engage with the issues that we're all talking about from a perspective that will be unknown, I think, to most of the students.
Right.
Because so many of my students come from rural Washington or Idaho.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So that's valuable time.
Yeah, I got my degree from Portland State University in philosophy.
Oh yeah, right on.
And, it was great, but like it's so I mean, I imagine my experience was so much like anytime I take a class on like religious studies or whatever, which I have a minor in, it's like you would always see like the class be very full at first, and then it would just empty out in, like, in the space of a couple of weeks. Because like you'd always, and there would always be like some like very heated argument between one of those students who was just a hardcore believer and the teacher. And
yeah,
I don't envy you those first couple of weeks. Those tense times at times, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's rough. Some of my colleagues in philosophy say, I never try to out my own personal beliefs through the quarter. I don't do that. I do it almost right away at the beginning of the quarter, because honestly, A, it would be almost impossible for me to keep that in.
Right.
I'm a very, very kind of outgoing person. But also, I want to let people know that, you know, maybe not everybody sees Christmas the way they do.
Right.
Sees, you know, taking an oath on the Bible, you know, as your president, you know, in the same way that they do or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be in their face. But, you know, again, we're in a pluralistic country. Star Trek helped prepare us to be in a pluralistic country. And so I think those experiences, I hope they're valuable. So,
yeah. Have you always been a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I have been a Star Trek fan for so long. It was in syndication on either the classic show on either KPLR 11 or Channel 30. These are the two FM type stations, or not FM, but UHF stations in St. Louis where I grew up. And yeah, watched it from an early age, so early that I really kind of didn't have much of an idea what was going on. But I do remember two things. I remember in fourth grade writing my first Star Trek story with a new ship and crew and everything. And I don't remember what it was about or any of the details, but I remember my scrabbly little handwriting on a sheet of paper. And I also remember being very prejudiced because of Star Trek against Star Wars before I saw it. And before I saw it, I had seen previews, and honestly, my attitude was, what is all this crazy anarchic aliens, you know, shooting at each other, Jawas running around? I said, this is like Star Trek with no dignity, you know. So I went, and of course, I loved it, and I was sold or whatever, but Star Trek provided me the lens that I first assessed Star Wars in terms of.
Etc. Again, here, like, Kira's looking to leave the station, giving up. Her religion has told her it's time to go and become a sculptor.
Yeah.
Because that's what her cast has told her it's good to do. Again, it is moving very quickly. Like, she's already made plans to move. And I'm not trying to denigrate the episode. I think it's very good. But it's you know.
Well, this is the sort of thing, Peter, that a story arc constructed, you know, Star Trek has the ability to play with a little bit more.
That's right.
And to me, the problem with story arcs, because they've also been introduced in the reboot of Doctor Who, which I'm a big fan of, is do they plan ahead? Do they have a satisfactory conclusion to them or not? Right? To me, often they don't. It looks like the conclusion was created kind of ad hoc. Right. Fairly late in the planning process. Maybe that's just the kind of viewer that I am, that I have higher expectations. But yeah, she's going to have to go. And so the team's going to start breaking up here unless something is done.
And touching base with O'Brien's storyline here. He's struggling with his, I mean, in some ways it's thematically linked, isn't it? It's like the expectation of your future and the seeming inevitability of it, right? And O'Brien's kind of struggling with that in terms of what his future is going to be holding for him.
Definitely is, yeah.
And the idea that this is supposed to be good news and a happy thing, but what are the consequences going to be?
Yeah. I got to say, though, I mean, I'm assuming that Keiko didn't say anything until she came to the station, because that's what we were shown. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like she should have let him know right away.
Yeah.
You know, over the hotline, so that he had just a little bit more. I know I would need that time to kind of come to grips.
It feels like kind of a, I don't know, older storytelling trope, right? Where, you know, oh, the girl shows up and she's, you know, 7 months pregnant. My God. You know, guy's been off on business. And yet, you know, Star Trek, where you have to imagine they could talk just as easily as any of us can talk today over phone.
Yeah.
Zoom, whatever, that they would theoretically be talking a lot. But, you know, when Keiko left, it was like under the auspices of like, I have to be gone for 6 months and we'll hardly ever see each other. And it's like, but don't you guys have communications? It's
all. And like transporters?
Yeah, well, I think that's a conceit with this one. It's like Keiko came back for a visit at some point and things got a little little frisky. And because she's not 6 months pregnant. She's like, not, you know, earlier than that, but like,
right,
it but still, I mean, I agree with you, like it you know, there's no talk about what we could be doing in this situation. It's more just like, oh yeah, pregnant, that's happening, great.
Yeah. And I mean, Keiko is a great character. She's a strong-headed, opinionated, incredibly intelligent character who's a very loving mom and trying to cope with Miles, trying to get along, you know, make him a better person. So
I feel like we have to talk about this though. I love this. It's this Vedic here has just killed someone because their cast was too low, essentially, and was giving off a bad aura. And if you think that's abhorrent, it's happened a lot in human history. A lot of what's even just happening today is connected to this.
So
used under different terminology, of course, but it's, you know.
No, that's right. I mean, this is a powerful scene. And again, you know, when I write about religion, which is not too frequently in publishing philosophy, whether that's philosophy and pop culture like Star Trek or more serious stuff, I mean, you have to take a historical perspective if that is available to you. And you have to take a perspective that is not naive about the use of power in societies, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that the so-called founders of America, particularly Madison, believed was that we've got to break up concentrations of power whenever possible. And so if you think about balance of powers, if you think about separation of church and state, if you think about, you know, the separate executive and two different houses of, they're all balancing maneuvers to attempt to prevent concentration of power.
Right.
And so my real worry, and I think that this is happening in America, unfortunately, again today, and it's regressive to me today, is that the beliefs of a minority of Americans, and frankly, that would be more evangelical or fundamentalist Protestant Christians together with some Catholics who are more more conservative, are being enacted into law.
And, yeah.
We can use phrases like religious liberty if we want. But I guess my question is always, who is being harmed by this?
Right.
And is there a good reason, knowing that we can't avoid all harm, for this harm? And this episode is just a really great example of that. It moves fast, you're right, Peter, but the relationships and the ideas of what a Coromon wants to do are credible. Well, and now we got to go check with the bosses.
Back into the wormhole.
Yeah. You know, it is an interesting kind of combination of tech and spirituality, and that you take a shuttle to go into the wormhole basically to talk to God.
Yeah,
that's right. And the orbs, right, are physical things that clearly the special effects show us that there's something scientifically as well as spiritually interesting going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now everybody gets to see their friends and family in the guise of the prophets, which I always thought was a great cost saving, but also opportunity for the actors to do something a little bit different that week.
Yeah, it's always fun. Always fun. done to a great effect in the pilot.
Yes, that's right.
You know, with, mm-hmm. with Jennifer, Jennifer's character as a
that's right
as a prophet. It's kind of a shame they didn't do more with that, honestly. Like, just having Jennifer as more.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah.
I forget who that actress is, but I really would have liked to have seen her come back in some way.
Yeah. I mean, she comes back for an episode as, like, the Mirror Universe Jennifer, and and they never quite hit the notes that you would expect them to hit with that statement. Like, this goes very, you know, it's very much like, oh, but you're not really my dead wife, and that's it. Right. And it's like, God,
yeah.
Speaking of Cisco's relatives,
it's all there.
I should do
like,
a shout out to Brock itself. Peters. I don't know, but is the only credible father for Cisco that I can imagine, and also one of those people that has been in like every genre, area, doing the voice of Darth Vader back on the old NPR adaptations of Star Wars, and
so many other
bring the Djarras so back. Is that true? Is that why you sent me there? Is that what you want?
I love how they call him the Cisco.
Yeah. It is this interesting note too that they play around with, which is like it seems like the prophets often don't quite understand what they've done to Bajor. Like, they're interacting with Bajor, and they obviously, you know, the orbs, but in a way they oftentimes feel like it's almost like, I don't know, like an afterthought or like something that they aren't quite cognizant of, like, oh, our orbs are like, we're creating this whole religion here and this is our whole thing. It's, you know, whereas like someone like, you know, if Q, and actually, Lisa, you did this in a short story, but like if Q wanted to start up a religion, it would be like kind of just to play around with people and fuck with them. And it's like, it always feels like the prophets are almost like, we don't understand what you're saying. Like, what do you mean? What kind of religion are you talking about?
I don't think the prophets, I might be going on a limb, but I don't think the prophets know that they're the focus of a religion.
Yeah,
I would agree with that.
Or what that is, right?
Yeah.
Because again, our understanding of what a religion is inherently tied to historical, the history and the tradition of the religion, and it presumes a kind of linear sort of thinking. But, and that again, that's a fascinating way of bridging sci-fi and religion, is to ask the question: are the sides equal? Right? I mean, are the worshippers and the worshipped on the same page?
Yeah, I mean, so it's Oh, and I guess they just killed that guy. That's okay.
Well, they brought him back to his time. I think.
Oh, that's right. I missed that.
Which is interesting because he's not an inconsequential figure.
No.
So does that change the course of the occupation now? I don't know. What did we blink and all of a sudden? That's a Doctor Who plot, but anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's a story all in itself, is what happens when you return this figure back to his place in history.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know if you two are familiar with the From a Certain Point of View books that have celebrated in Star Wars the various anniversaries of episodes 4, 5, 6. That would be a fascinating thing to do for important stories in Star Trek history, is to give to put together, you know, some very short meditations on what happened after or what happened before.
Yeah. Yeah, here's an example of Keiko going, go away.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if the actress here, I hope she's doing well. I wish she, I don't know if she gets to the conventions or anything, but she's in a lot of Star Trek, and she, you know,
Rosalind Chow,
I'm sure she deserves more of the autograph lines than, you know, unnamed ensign number 3 or whatever, who always pops up at the conventions or something like that. But
what this says that she's going to be in an adaptation of Cixin Liu's Three Body Problem. All right.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
The one that's done by the Game of Thrones guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it's going to be a Netflix series.
Okay. Right on.
Done by the old Game of Thrones showrunners.
Oh, cool.
In some ways, what we've been talking about with regard to the prophets is also true of Three Body, because as I was talking to, I have more international friends who have read that piece of sci-fi than almost anything from America or Britain. Or maybe we just talk about it a lot, but the aliens there are never seen in the entire
story.
They don't interact with the humans directly. And so it's kind of a curious thing of how it's more about how humans react and react upon their reactions based on information coming from many light years away that takes a long time, and from aliens that we don't really know much about.
Yeah. Here's here they're talking about the timelines that changed when he went back to his own time.
Yeah. Prophets work in mysterious ways. Always love a bookend. I try to do my philosophy and pop culture courses with a bookend because of the influence of Next Generation.
Yeah.
I like at the end to try to come around to what we started with a new perspective on it that we've gotten as a result of going through weeks of class or whatever. And I always tell the students it's a bookend, and I always say, like in Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, all good things. And they just stare back blankly. How long am I going to be able to continue doing this? So
it is
clear that
it is,
they need a lesson in screenwriting.
Yeah, it is so fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
it is so fascinating as we get to the end of the episode here. But it's, I mean, this is probably a topic for another time completely. But it's like that Starfleet would be okay with Sisko being this emissary for this religious group. It's like, it feels like something that would be very kind of like, what do you mean? That's a lot of cultural contamination there. We're not cool with that. But like, but they're okay with
given
it.
Given their status.
Yeah. Okay, and like,
that could have been a good episode right there, or even a short arc of Sisko going back to Earth and having to argue his position.
Yeah.
And of course, really he's kind of like Riker, right? In Measure of a Man, is that maybe in season one, he doesn't really want to argue for it.
Right.
Right.
He loves the Bajoran people and really wants them to benefit.
Also,
I think there's...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say that they kind of set up Deep Space Nine as being like out in the middle of nowhere. And so it could be that they're kind of at the edge of the Federation. And so the Federation itself doesn't really bother with them.
Well, I think it's more so that like the wormhole coming into effect, and then like the Dominion War kicking into gear, like Federation's like, no, we actually don't want to piss off the Bajorans all that much anymore. So like, if they want to see you as a god, it could help us out later, which is kind of a weird, you know, political move for Starfleet to make. And, to Kevin's point, I really wish that they had done like an arc or something, an episode, just to confront that head on, because they kind of just never, unless I'm misremembering this, but they kind of just are like, they're uncomfortable with it, but they let me do my thing type thing. And it's interesting.
Right.
But
well,
anyway, episode's over. Kevin, what's upcoming and new in your life?
Well, about halfway through putting together with a fellow named Matthew Brake a book called The Witcher and Philosophy, which should be out in 2024, I think.
Great.
And just really continuing to love teaching, particularly a class that I invented when I got to Eastern Washington University in Spokane, where I teach. Called Philosophical Voices in Popular Culture, where we do what you guys do right here every week, which is to watch episodes of Star Wars or Star Trek or Doctor Who or The Walking Dead, and to really use that as use the pop culture artifact as a jumping off point for talking about really, I mean, anything. Star Trek is very fruitful in that regard. I'm going to do The Good Place and Philosophy next year. I think I'm finally ready for that.
Yeah.
And The Good Place from NBC a couple of years ago is, again, one of the intrinsically philosophical shows because it's about, you know, getting into the good place and staying away from the bad place after you die and what happens if you, a clerical error means that you ended up in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Anyway, looking forward to teaching that and to further books, maybe even another Star Trek and Philosophy, number three.
Great.
I think
so. Are you online anywhere that we could find you?
I am so busy with reading, writing, and teaching that I don't maintain much of an online presence. So people can read my St. Louis-based author bio on Amazon, and that's probably about the most they'll find out about me aside from this program today. He loves Ted Drew's custard, Emo's pizza, and bike riding.
Long bike rides on the beach.
Well, it's been great watching this with you.
Yeah,
and I would absolutely love to do that. I mean, you picked the episode, and I bet we could talk it up. So
terrific,
much appreciated.
That'd be wonderful.
Glad to be part of this project.
And so for listeners out there, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us at TrekSpiritsBR on Twitter or TrekSpiritsBriefingRoom on Instagram. We post behind the scenes images and previews about upcoming episodes. And of course, support the Writers Guild strike, as we hope all of you will do as well. So for Lisa Klink, myself, I want to say thank you for everyone at the Glorious TrekSpirits podcast network, Mark Altman, Darren Doctorman, Mark Rivera. And until next time, thanks for being here. And the briefing room is now closed.
Mr. Scott, will you repeat what you just told us?
About an hour ago, the bridge control started going crazy. Levers shifting by themselves, buttons being pushed, instrument readings changing.
And on my monitor screen, I can see Mitchell smiling each time it happened, as if his ship and crew were almost a toy for his amusement.